It's a bit of a squeeze to live there. You have to really think twice before you buy anything.
At just 24 square metres each, the smaller residences at London's modernist Isokon building are bijou, to say the least. Yet the whitewash building remains one of the city's most sought-after living spaces.
There was also sort of a political, philosophical aspect of that. Why do you need so many possessions? Unfortunately, today people have more things than they used to have.
We'll find out what today's developers and architects can learn from the scale and design of buildings like this one. Coming up today on Section D. Hello from London, I'm Josh Fennett and this is Section D, Monocle 24's weekly design show. Also ahead...
You can see a tiny little bird here that's going into the birdcage. There's a little plate that's going to close the birdcage with a diamond in it and a little ring on the top.
We'll visit the workshop of Ole Lindegaard, a Danish jewellery design firm that's dazzling with its approach to handcrafted accessories. Plus,
we have to know that design is not just a product, but design is also a way of thinking. Design is a kind of medium that can change our perception of the world.
The first of our reports from the Ljubljana Design Biennale. Our mini-series asks whether the fact that the events spread across all of Slovenia helps or hinders its core message. That's all coming up today on Section D on Monocle 24. And we start today's show right here in London, where an exhibition is shedding light on private housing solutions from the 1930s. Solutions that could teach London developers a thing or two today about scale and charm. Now, Hampstead in the UK capital's north is better known for tall, brick-built Victorian townhouses and a heath than it is for modernist piles. But the Isokon building is a rare landmark in this respect, amidst the parkland and well-tended streets. After he fled Germany, but before he crossed the pond for the States, Bauhaus founder Walter Gropius lived in this 1934-built building. The latest exhibition by the gallery casts a new light on the clever conception of the still-inhabited structure to chime with the 80th anniversary of Gropius's departure. Amid the fallout of the Grenfell Tower tragedy in London, it's also a subtle nudge to architects and developers who need to consider London's private housing, which is underfunded, embattled and often poorly conceived. Now, Magnus Endland is himself a veteran of the design industry. He's one of the founders of the retailer Scandium here in London and currently calls the Isokon building home. Englund joins me in the studio now. Magnus, welcome to Section D. Now, this is a fascinating exhibition. Could you tell me what makes the Isokon building worthy of consideration today?
The Isokon is a very special building for several reasons. Most buildings that are listed purely for their architectural merit. Isokon building is listed Grade 1. Only 3% of all buildings in Britain are listed Grade 1. And very, very few buildings built after the First World War are listed Grade 1. So the combination of the two of them being a relatively modern building.
And what's the reason for that? What about this building has echoed through the ages?
First of all, it's the building technique, because it was the first reinforced concrete block of flats. There had been modernist, Corbusier-style buildings before built in Britain as private villas, but this was the first block of flats. And it's quite a radical, stark modernism. Leaving the modern, this slightly sort of jazz age, art deco influenced building that had been before, while this one was pure, which really makes it look in the Victorian surroundings where it is as a spaceship that has landed, even to this day.
Well, give us a sense of the size of it. So it's in Hampstead, a kind of relatively affluent, leafy, and as you mentioned, an area defined by kind of brick buildings and pretty front gardens and a slightly dated aesthetic. As you approach the building, what do people see and why is it such a stark contrast to the surroundings?
It has a slight pinkish tone to it, but you don't really see that unless the sun is setting or coming up. So it's completely white compared to its surrounding, really. It's not a very tall building. It's only four stories high, but it's 36 flats now. When it opened originally, it had 32 flats. It has something of an ocean liner about it. It's slightly odd in that the part facing the street only has the doors and the kitchen windows to each flat visible. The main windows are actually on the back, so it's also slightly secretive, the building, which is very suitable for it because it had at least four confirmed Soviet spies that lived there in the 1930s that worked for the NKVD or the GRU, the civil or the military Soviet intelligence.
Some great intrigue in the building's history. And as you mentioned, Gropius's time in the UK was rather fleeting. So he fled Germany, I believe, in 1934. He was here until 1937. He'd famously set up the Bauhaus much earlier in 1919. I wonder what effect this great man who went on to forge a world-renowned career later, arguably more in the US than for his work in the UK. What lessons did he leave behind here in those kind of turbulent years in the 30s?
It's an interesting period, of course, with Gropius coming over here. As you said, he had to flee Nazi Germany, and Jack Pritchard, the founder of the Isagon, was instrumental in getting him over and also offered him and his wife Isa a free flat. They never paid for the flat when they lived at the Isagon. And Jack Pritchard also desperately tried to get him work here. But that was difficult. It was too early for his style. He was a foreigner bringing in a new language and architecture, which wasn't really appreciated in Britain in the way it was in the United States, which of course is why he left after less than 3 years and took up his position at Harvard. But the buildings built after the war, I think that's where his influence can be seen more than anything else, when Britain was building up the welfare program with the first Labour government. So I think he was just too early. And his only major building, really, that he ever built in Britain is Impington Village College outside Cambridge. And when you see that today, particularly for me being a Scandinavian, it reminds me of lots of school buildings I saw in Scandinavia when I grew up in the 60s and 70s. It's just, you have to think, it isn't from the 60s or 70s, it's from the 1930s.
And at the risk of making this building sound like a sort of stuffy throwback to an architecturally important time of the past, I mean, I should mention that you live in this building. It remains a vibrant place, and the form of it and the furniture within it are still part of how people live in London today. I wonder if you can tell me about how the design was radically different, how the use of space, how the conception of what this building was supposed to be was so different from what existed before it, and maybe, you know, what it can teach us today, if anything, about how we should be building homes.
Most of the flats, with the exception of the Pritchard's penthouse, which is where I'm likely to live, but most of the flats are of the minimum type, which was something that had been brought up at the CIM, the International Congress of Modern Architecture, already in the late 1920s. So the existence minimum, as the Germans called it, was way of solving the housing crisis, which of course is a problem we have today as well, not least in London. So they really took it back to the bare minimums. The flats are only 24 square meters, which is below modern UK building regs. Today they have to be 38 square meters. And the kitchens were purposely done very small because there was food making facilities on the ground floor and you could call down and have your food sent up in a dumbwaiter. And later on in 1937, the Isobar opened with a restaurant, also on the ground floor. So it was really for busy professionals, single people who used it as a London bolt hole with not too many possessions. And there was also sort of a political, philosophical aspect of that why do you need so many possessions? Unfortunately today people have more things than they used to have back then. So it's a bit of a squeeze to live there. You have to really think twice before you buy anything.
It's interesting. I completely agree with you that these buildings can have a philosophical or a kind of political push from their design, from the way that they encourage you to live. I wonder, you know, what you would distill those principles as being. I mean, if we look at Le Corbusier, everyone had a balcony in certain buildings. There was this idea that everyone should have access to communal spaces, that there was a certain humanity in providing these things for people. What about the Isagon building is kind of unique to Gropius's philosophy or that of the Bauhaus, do you think?
It's something about the scale of it, which is still very humane. It reminds me quite a lot, and it also reminded Wells Coates and Jack Pritchard when they built it, of the Prellerhaus at the Bauhaus in Dessau, the building where the students live, which are fairly small rooms. You can go there today and stay in one of them, which is a lovely stay. And we found recently with the Pritchard family film reels from the 30s when they actually went to Bauhaus Dessau and they filmed exactly the balconies of the student part of the Dessau building. As you can see the influence there directly.
I want to ask you a little bit, and this is slightly speculative, you can shrug when I ask you this, But, you know, I get the sense that there's been a bit of a revisionist turn in the idea of modernism, the idea of brutalism. There's a huge publishing bounty of amazing books looking at these austere concrete buildings and looking back at them very fondly, when perhaps you could argue that a lot of these buildings haven't proved fit for purpose over time. I just wonder how you think, you know, we are learning these lessons from the great luminaries of architecture of the past. Do we risk romanticising how great these buildings are, or should we be looking at them to learn how people aspired to live better?
I think you're partly right. It's a combination of the two, really. Of course, some of them were mistakes, and I think over time also they became less and less humane. But it's interesting to see with shifting generations, the generation of Wells Coates, Jack Pritchard, Gropius, they thought that Victorian architecture was awful, absolutely awful. But they looked back at Georgian architecture and thought that that was good architecture, perfectly good. Therefore, after the Second World War, a lot of Victorian architecture was demolished. Now today, people think that it's actually quite nice with Victorian architecture. And the 1930s modernist buildings are no longer under threat either, because they have been accepted. While the Isochron was voted the second most ugly building in Britain in the mid-50s. Now we're seeing a new shift, as you're saying, with brutalism being accepted by a younger generation, while the slightly older generation still think that that's a complete eyesore. So every generation seemed to hate what came last. I mean, I have a problem with postmodernism. I don't know, a lot of other people do, but at the same time, I know the 20th Century Society, they are sort of confident now that they can protect brutalism, but the next one they're fearing that will be lost is postmodernism.
Magnus Englund there, a resident of the Isochron building here in London, and one of the team involved in corralling a new exhibition paying tribute to the great Walter Gropius. The exhibition, Walter Gropius, architect, teacher, Isochron resident, runs until October. Next stop, Denmark, specifically the neighbourhood of Hellerup in Copenhagen. It's here that Danish jewellery brand Ole Lindegaard has been forging a reputation for gold jewellery since 1963. Its founder, the eponymous Ole Lindegaard, who is 81, is still in the workshop most days. However, his daughter Charlotte and son Soren have taken over as the creative head and CEO of the firm. With fashion brands from Hermes to H&M all flogging their own jewellery collections, is there still a niche for traditional high-end companies in an increasingly tough and ever price-conscious market? Monocle's Elna Nyken and Anderson paid a visit to the workshop to find out old Lindegaard's recipe for success.
At the workshop of the family-owned jewellery company Ole Lindegaard in Hellerup, a leafy, peaceful neighbourhood just north of Copenhagen's centre, a team of more than 40 goldsmiths is hard at work. Many of them arrive as early as 5 a.m. to start working on their projects. Crafting, for example, one of the company's signature pieces, a golden birdcage charm, takes several days. Søren Lindegaard, CEO of the company, shows us around the workshop and explains how everything here is made by hand.
You can see a tiny little bird here that's going into the birdcage. There's a little plate that's going to close the birdcage with a diamond in it, and a little ring on the top, and with a pin through it and an extra lock. So 9 small pieces is what the jeweler will use to finish this sweet drop. So there's a lot of work into every piece of jewelry.
All the company's gold and jewelry start their lives here at the casting department. The goldsmiths create individual molds for each piece, which are then filled with gold and heated in special ovens for 14 hours.
We have the gold in here. We have an argon gas overpressure to prevent the gold from oxidizing. We have vacuum down here. And when everything is ready, the gold is melted, we press this bottom and the gold is pushed down into the mold of the casting. And we then have our mold filled with gold, and the gold is 1,000 degrees, but very quickly, within 1 minute, it's solid.
Goldsmith Ole Lindegaard started making jewellery in these same premises back in 1963. Since then, the company has grown considerably, but it's still very much a family affair. Ole's son, Søren, is the CEO, and his daughter Charlotte, the creative director. Søren's wife Hanna takes care of the retail, while Charlotte's husband works as the chief commercial officer. Ole himself lets his children run the company, but still visits the workshop almost every day. Today the company has flagship stores in Copenhagen, Stockholm and Sydney, but an international expansion is being planned. This summer, a new store will open in the heart of Paris at Place Vendôme. Charlotte tells us more about the plans.
We want to be in some of the big cities with our shops, but we still want it to be the little like family company, again, that I was talking about the handcraft, so we're not compromising. And that's sometimes something that companies always have to take care of. I think no matter if it's jewelry design or fine jewelry or fashion, that growing bigger, not to grow too fast, so you always take care of the company and what you stand for and the ideas from the beginning. When you enter our shops, you need to have this feeling of, I would like to stay here. And this is by the emotional thing and the handcraft and everything and the staff there. And not only look nice the first couple of weeks or month, our shops, they really have to have all the time. Everything has to be so you get this, a nice experience each time you go into our shops, no matter which country you are in.
Jewelry is currently having a major fashion moment. Since a few years back, most fashion houses and high street brands have their own jewelry collections, and many consumers are attracted by the total look, where everything, including the jewelry, comes from the same brand. For a company specialized in expensive fine jewelry, this brings new challenges. How can a family-run, small business make its voice heard in this increasingly tough and price-conscious market? According to Charlotte and Ole, the key is to stay true to your unique style. So how does a piece from Ole Lingard stand out from the crowd?
It's strange, but no matter if it's Charlotte who makes it, I make a jewelry, you can always see that it belongs to the collection. You can always see, oh yes, no doubt, this is from Hellerup, this is from Copenhagen and Ole Lingard.
I think we use a lot of hours. Yeah. I think that's what I can see, because there are a lot of also fashion brands now making fine jewelry and there are jewelry and that from when I started, and I'm sure when you started, there were so now there are so many people in interest of jewelry and doing jewelry and making jewelry, so you really have to do something which is where you really can see like the handcraft. So we trying to make our jewelry more and more difficult to do and more complicated and more design and more so you can see the difference. Yes, so you know when you get you have a trust in what we do. So people, when they buy our jewelry, they need to have this feeling of believing in the brand and the stones we're using and everything.
Once the separate pieces of the jewelry have been made, they are taken to the workshop where the final piece is put together. The same person makes each jewelry from start to finish. But before any new designs are launched, they are tested at the model department, sometimes for years. Søren explains how his father's snake collection, typical for the brand's organic style that often gets its inspiration from nature, was born.
First he made a full collection and it was ready to be presented for the sales. Then he decided, no, it wasn't really perfect, so he threw everything away after 1 year of work and came back and made the snake collection again. I think Morten was very much, how many snake collections did we make?
Three.
Three. Three. Over 2 years, we made three different snake collections until we had the one that you see today.
Soon, this collection, along with all the other ones, will reach new consumers as the company continues its international expansion. But anywhere they go, they always work as a team. And Ole, who turned 81 in May, is eager to be part of the company's future.
Singapore we are opening after. Singapore here in a month or something, month and a half. And then Munich. But we are opening in Singapore soon. And then Munich is, we work on other places, yeah. But we take it step by step.
For me personally, it's great to still be able to come to work every day and to have my ideas and be able to come down here and
see them done and see them, young people take them out. Say, oh, that's fantastic. And people ask me, when do you start the work? And will you just continue like that? And I say, yes, when I feel old, if I one day feel old, I'll stop.
But I don't think you'll ever feel old or stop.
A visit to the busy workshop of Danish jewellery brand Ulla Lindegaard there. Our thanks to Elna, Nyken and Anderson for that dazzling report. Next up, we set sail for Slovenia for a report on the nation's budding design scene from its long-running design biennale. Bio 25, as it's billed, is subtitled Far Away, So Close. Consisting of a fairly traditional exhibition in Ljubljana's Museum of Architecture and Design, the show also features 7 episodes in different locations around the country, from a coast to a cave and a forest to a mining town. It all adds up to something of a challenge for the 7 separate international designers involved, not to mention visitors who are being asked to set aside their preconceptions about design, as well as cover some ground to appreciate the show. Monocle's Belgrade correspondent Guy Delorne was in Ljubljana to get a grip with a far-flung event.
It's the evening before the opening of the Ljubljana Design Biennial, and already it's clear that this isn't going to be your average talking shop or exhibition of desirable objects in a room. It's not the skiffle band outside this gallery next to Ljubljana's famous Triple Bridge. It's the presentation inside, a collection of potted plants connected to electrodes and a live graph of the price of metals on the world's commodity exchanges. Confused? You probably will be, and this isn't even part of the design biennial proper. It's just the prelude. Discombobulating jaded design aficionados is the aim, but the director of Ljubljana's Museum of Architecture and Design, Mateusz Celik, says there's method behind the brain-warping shenanigans.
So we have a research by Jonata Gatto that is called GeoMERS, and it's about plants that are hyper-absorb you for heavy metals.
This is not sort of a traditional design or what people might expect from a design biennial, but it is very much connected with themes of the environment, post-industrial landscape, rural landscape possibly. So I suppose this is very much setting the scene for what's to come.
Exactly, that's true. Because this biennial is going to take us to some places that otherwise we wouldn't have gone to.
A little wine helped to take the edge off that experience, but the strongest beverage on offer the next morning is coffee. And at the museum, biennial co-curators Maya Vadian and Angela Rui are introducing their concept to the assembled crowd of designers, dignitaries and humble hacks.
Design, and for those who are not familiar with the biennial, I will just tell you a few things about its history. It was established in 1963 and it's the oldest design biennial in the world.
The biennial's theme is Far Away, So Close, and just to prove they mean it, the curators have not only set up displays at the museum, they've coordinated them with what they call episodes in locations around Slovenia. There are 7 in all, taking in everything from coastline to caves and forests to mining towns. Each episode is directed by a renowned international designer, including the likes of Didier Faustino, former Fantasma and Point Supreme architects. But they work alongside what the curators call a profile, a Slovenian who can be notable in any field so long as it's not design. Maya Vadian says they're aiming to use design to make a better world by making people think.
So I think majority of people understand design as a product. That's something that makes their life easier, something that makes their life more beautiful. But the reality is, do we really need more products? And in fact, we have to know that design is not just a product, but design is also a way of thinking. Design is a kind of medium that can change our perception of the world.
How did the designers respond to all this? Because I imagine it's not the sort of thing that they're usually asked to do at a design biennial.
I think it was a very difficult task for them. You get a topic, you get a situation, you get a double installation, one is on site, the other is in the museum. You get a profile who is not from your field and you don't know. You get a group of designers that you select through the open call, and of course you need to react to that. So it was a kind of expedition what they did, you know, a kind of travel where they discovered their own identity, but also they kind of questioned their own profession for through that.
What we came out with is that the idea itself of Europe was changing, and the migration were showing a new, different way to be.
Connecting design with current events in Slovenia means reflecting the refugee crisis. Hundreds of thousands of people came through this tiny country in 2015, most of them hoping to reach Western Europe. The curators asked Italian industrial designer Oddo Fioravante to interpret this in his work, which they called New Heroes. His answer was an installation in the coastal town of Piran and five spear-like objects to display in the museum. Each of them are twists on standard home appliances, like kitchen blenders, adapted to the needs of desperate people on a hazardous journey. It succeeds in being both intriguing and moving, and the process had a profound effect on the designer.
To me, it was a challenge. I'm not a typical industrial designer. I did classical studies. And sometimes I feel that when the people say you're just an industrial designer, they're just reducing what you are to a technician, less than a thinker, you know. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I keep thinking that most of the engineers or technicians have a fantastic and incredible humanistic side. Mm-hmm. So this is what I try to show, this part of me.
So you're using this almost like intellectual food to for your design work.
Yeah, this is what I try to do, is bring back and show that an industrial designer can be delicate, can be thoughtful, can be also brainy.
What do you think, having done this project, that you're going to take back to your regular industrial design work?
What I bring back is that the idea that I don't have to hide this humanistic part of my person, and I can show it. We spent the last 20 years thinking that goods could be artificial, non-human, distant from persons, you know, edgy, repulsing and rejecting people. And I think we have to bring back the humans at the center of the design process and start again with this idea, because we can't avoid being human.
We are, since migration is part of being human, part of
Otto's Slovenian muse, or profile, has a particularly apt specialism, given the episode's allusions to sea voyages. Marin Medak is a transatlantic rower and international kayaker.
The first time they called me, 2 years ago, I said that they must have the wrong number because I'm not the person they're looking for.
What did it look like, your collaboration? How often were you getting together?
So we got together 4 or 5 times. It was quite intense. The first time when we met just Oddo and myself, I brought him kayaking on a lake, and it was also his first time in a sea kayak, so it was also a new experience for him. We were telling stories, discussing things, who is a hero nowadays, who is not a hero, and we had so many different opinions about that. And then it was Oddo's mind that shaped all that thoughts into the reality, to this object.
The opening party was just the start of the adventure for the design-loving Liggers. Their minds and bodies were about to be tested by a midnight subterranean adventure, and they'd also be heading around the country to the woods, the sea, and Slovenia's post-industrial landscape. Monocle will, of course, be going with them. For Monocle in Ljubljana, I'm Guy Delaunay.
Monocle's Belgrade correspondent Guy Delaunay in Ljubljana there with the first report in a short mini-series about the city's design biennale. And sadly, that's all we have time for on this week's show. My very special thanks to our ever-patient editor, Alex Funnell, the girl behind the glass, Claire Urban, and this show's proud producer, Ben Ryland. If you have any comments or queries, then do feel free to write Ben a note at br@monocle.com. And remember, we're back at the self-same time next week. That's all for Section D. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.